and beetle boots. Nobody notices the middle-aged painter at the entrance, with his adolescent son in tie and blazer. The artist's giggly banter sounds across the room, names drifting mystifyingly into Pinch's ears. Henry Geldzahler and Barry Goldwater and Lee Strasberg. Worryingly, he hasn't heard of any of those artists. On a far wall, two blue fluorescent beams are mounted into an X. Beside this hangs a collage of Heinz ads. The largest work, however, is a plywood board stenciled with pink and yellow speech bubbles that contain no speech. Unsure how to react, Pinch turns to his father. "Planning to buy?" the black woman asks, approaching Bear. "Or just looking?" "Neither, if it's all the same to you," he replies. Smirking, she asks what brings him here and looks most entertained to hear his name. "Shit, I heard of you, but you're not on tonight." "Lovely lady, if I had something on these walls, nobody would look at anything else," Bear tells her, charm turned up. Dad loathes these occasions, Pinch knows, yet he masters a room so effortlessly. He's not even friendly to people, but they seem to like that. "Which is you?" he asks her. She points to the speech bubble artwork. "Plus a few more to come. I'm waiting on a delivery man." "You're not the ketchup lover, I take it." "That's my friend Renee. You don't dig that? If I was in the market for a hamburger, I don't doubt your friend Renee would have all kinds of useful advice. Till then, I suggest he quits pretending to do anything more than drivel." "He's right there. You can tell him yourself." "More than happy to." Bear lifts a bottle of beer from her hand and places it into his son's. "Now, this young man," he informs her, clutching Pinch's shoulder. "This is an actual proper painter. Right here. He's the one you should know, not this hooey on the walls." She cocks her head at Pinch, noticing him for the first time. "What's your name, young man?"
Charles,
he replies faintly, and offers his sweaty hand to shake. Instead, she takes back her beer, sips it, then returns the bottle, her eyes sparkling. "You gonna be famous, big guy?" Smiling, he glances at Dad.
"You don't know his work?"
Bear responds, slinging an arm protectively around young Pinch.
"You ain't heard of Charlie Bavinsky? And you call yourself an artist?"
"Wait one minute. You saying this is the Charlie Bavinsky in the flesh?"
Pinch laughs, blushing. She takes her beer full time now, summoning her friends and elaborating on the prodigy in their midst. One of the men touches Pinch's head for benediction, saying, "You are the future." As more people turn up for the hanging, each is introduced to Charlie Bavinsky, artist of tomorrow. With every introduction, the fanfare grows, each new entrant hearing another layer of grandiosity.
"The world-famous genius Charlie,"
and
"Charlie B., master of all forms, spiritual and sexual,"
and
"Charlie Bavinsky, visionary."
Pinch, casting wild-eyed looks at his father, is pulled from one side to another, these artists pouring at him, sharing beers with him, asking kooky questions for the others to overhear.
"Everyone knows," the black woman says, "that age is just a number."
She plants a kiss on Pinch's lips, causing his legs to shake and everyone else to buckle with laughter. Pinch stands there, knowing, for the first time in his life, knowing that this is his setting, and these are his people. Gradually, conversations bubble elsewhere. The mob disperses. Pinch spins about, seeking someone else to question him. The black woman is against a wall, prodding at the chest of Bear, who mock falls back a step.
"I know you," she says, waggling a finger at him. "You're one of those guys still got paint stains on his sneakers. I didn't think they made your kind no more." "Nah, what they make, sweetie, is shit, which is everything in this room today."
Everyone laughs. They think he's joking.
"See?" the woman teases. "This is why you folks in such a bad mood. You used to be in charge."
"I'm out of date, you're saying?
Baby, you're old, but don't take my word for it. Let's find you a mirror."
The sharper their exchange, the more Bear chortles, till everyone turns at the arrival of a portly man around 60, Victor Petros, owner of this gallery, who is gasping from one flight of stairs, cigarette scissored between hairy middle finger and brass signet ring, sandalwood cologne emitting from large pores. He sloughs off his overcoat, allowing it to slump onto the floor, and he greets a few young artists, caressing an arm of each. He reaches Bear, finally, taking both of the painter's hands, leading him away for a private chat. Pinch, tipsy from beer, overheated, unsure of what to feel or where to stand, follows after his dad.
"You approve, fine sir?"
Petros is asking Bear, wiping his mouth from side to side, nostrils twitching. Departing a home on 57th Street was not without bitterness. But walls must be had, my dear bear. Meaty walls for meaty masterpieces such as yours. Those lunatic Pavinsky glories hanging above the chasm of disaster, only to pull back at the last. In a spurt of tipsy irritation, Pinch almost announces this stupid description. Petros continues, I know, Bear, I know. It's not your style tonight. Nor mine, perhaps. But that's the market. Alas, I trust you'll be in attendance for the big splash later. There'll be scribes and sausage rolls and sensational dames. I got the youngster in tow. Pinch stands higher, presenting himself to the famed dealer for appraisal, a trifle defiantly, then hastily dabbing sweat from his upper lip. What do you think of it all? Petros asks. You're young. Can you see any value in these works? I think it's drivel, Pinch declares, glancing at his father, then back at Petros, the boy's neck flushing. Youth speaks, Bear says, chuckling. This prompts Pinch to push onward. Nobody who has taste could like this junk. Why would anyone put this on their wall? It's for idiots. Noting the glare of Petros, Pinch falters. It isn't... The dealer contemplates this spotty adolescent, as if struggling to discern a feature of minimal worth. Pinch is desperate to maintain poise, yet racked by his childish outburst, having shown off so stupidly, having insulted this important man, whom Pinch has dreamed might someday represent him alongside Dad. Suddenly, Pinch glimpses himself, a little nothing among adults, who see how stupid he looks, a schoolboy in suit and tie. Petros takes a puckery drag of cigarette. When do I get a studio visit, Bear? That's why you pulled me down here, Vic, to try that on again. I invited you to see our new dwelling, dear man. Then I might receive your blessing for the move. But naturally, I'm ever hopeful that you have fresh work for me. In a long while. As I say to all my artists, popularity is a tan. It fades when out of the light. What is that supposed to tell me? That you must have pictures in your studio I could discreetly place with a few choice collectors, if only to keep your name among the living. Bear? When I'm ready is when you get something. If you're planning to push my painting into some of your rich know-nothings, you won't see anything ever. Don't tell me you're still insisting on museums. You know how needlessly complicated this makes my life. Vic, if you don't like my terms, tell me so. Tell me. Play whatever games you want with these twerps you got showing tonight, but I'm a grown man. You don't bring me all the way into the city for this. Petros goes into backstroke, recasting what he just said, lavishing praise on the unique vision of Bear Bavinsky, even while gently scolding Dad for not making work like everyone else. It's the market, he claims, conspiring against us both. Pinch wants to ask, but aren't you, Victor Petros, part of that market? An awkward young woman in glasses sidles up, whispering to Petros about his meeting with Alfred and René at Momma. So glorious to have shown you our new cathedral, Petros concludes. It means the world to have your blessing. He looks again at Pinch. Everyone tells me that you are an artist, too, and with great promise, not to mention strong opinions. We'll get properly acquainted tonight. Agreed? Pinch nearly leaps in the air. Instead, he nods. Yes, thank you. Thanks. Bear watches. A little chuckle, arm around his kid, leading him away. As they descend for the street, Petros hurries to the top of the stairs, calling down a final thought to Bear. Red, yellow, and blue. Primary colors make collectors happy. Keep that in mind. He waves an unlit cigarette and returns to younger clients. Bear walks fast away with Pinch matching his pace. Not sure where they're headed to, but ready to sprint there, barely able to suppress his drunken tongue from blabbing about all that transpired. He aches for Dad to speak, to say whether that was triumph or disaster, if Pinch conducted himself acceptably. They walk in silence, Pinch buttoning and unbuttoning his jacket, armpits damp and itchy. At Washington Square Park, a college kid is playing the banjo, wailing Pete Seeger while old-world retirees hunch over chessboards. The metal railings are laden with paintings for sale, tawdry sunsets, and Picasso knockoffs. These people showing at the gallery, Pinch begins, watching his father. It's like they weren't even doing the same profession as you. His father keeps walking up Fifth Avenue until leading Pinch through a revolving door into a hotel lobby. You have a room for the young man? He asks the front desk.
Get you fixed right up.
Pinch goes cold. He's being left here, and can't object. He saw Birdie remonstrate with their father, and it never ended well.
Here's a buck for the bellboy,
Bear says, slipping his son a dollar, turning back to the revolving door.
But will Mr. Petrus mind if I don't come back?
Pinch asks, suppressing desperation. I was supposed to speak with him later, I think.
Get anything you want, Charlie boy. Room service, anything. On me, kiddo.
And he's gone. Up in his room, Pinch stands in bewilderment, still muzzy from the booze, mouth dry. He punches his thigh, hammering it three times, tears welling up. In confusion, he keeps flashing to before. Dad telling everyone I'm an artist. Once calmer, Pinch toys with the radio in the headboard, tunes into a ball game. He's never heard one before. He leans out the window, scanning the concrete far below, seeing his father and every thick-shouldered guy who plods towards the hotel. Drowned out by car horns, Pinch states his name to the smoggy summer air, as if encountering real artists again, telling them about his influences. He replays those interchanges, except that he kisses back when the black artist pecks his lips. Pinch leaps onto the bed, landing on his knees, then darts back to the window, studying the pavements. As hours pass, the concrete below turns darker grey until the street lamps pop, coating the asphalt white, passing yellow stripes of taxicabs, red dots from a traffic light down the next block. Only at breakfast does he see Dad again, there at the back of the hotel restaurant. Across from there is the black woman from yesterday, wearing the same Mondrian dress, a little rumpled this morning. She is caressing Bear's open palm. He clasps her fingers, brings them to his mouth, a playful bite. Bear notices his son, nods, not calling the boy over. 20. Bear sleeps on the train back to Larchmont, with Pinch watching. Lightly he rests his hand on his father's upper arm, which rises and falls with the man's heavy breaths. Stirring, Bear utters a peaceful sigh, draws his son closer, as if pulling a bony little cushion under his arm.
What a time, Bear mumbles. Told you we'd turn that place upside down.
His eyes remain shut, crow's feet deepening from amusement.
What an impression you made. I love the hell out of you, Charlie.
At the gallery? Pinch says, needing to hear this again.
We made a scene all right.
But not for talking about, hey? He opens one eye.
You got that, kiddo?
After the gallery, we ate hamburgers for dinner at the hotel, Pinch responds, as if recounting to Carol.
With plenty of Heinz ketchup, Bear adds.
The boy laughs, recalling that idiotic collage. And baseball on the radio.
You are a solid customer, Bear says,
touching his forehead to Pinch's temple, before settling back to sleep. But Pinch still awaits an answer about moving here for good. As the train slows into Larchmont, passengers stand, smoothing suit jackets, collecting hats from the overhead racks, adjusting brims. Bear leaps to his feet, lifting Pinch as if he were a brown paper parcel.
Back in the suburbs, young man, he says. Time to adopt our disguises, Charlie boy. Ready?
Carol waits on the platform, talking a blue streak about Widgeon's tonsillitis. Back at the house, Pinch runs to his room, opens his suitcase with a rolled-up painting inside. He darts to the top of the stairs, cooling down when Bear passes along the corridor.
Can I show you that picture I brought? Would that be okay?
Be right up, Charlie.
Chilly with sweat, Pinch sits on his bed, legs jiggling. The murmur of his father's phone conversation downstairs drifts up, punctuated by Bear's thunderous laughter, each bolt of which hits Pinch with such love for this man. The call ends. Bear clomps upstairs.
Well, kiddo, what you got? I know I'm gonna love this.
Pinch unrolls the canvas and swallows.
Remember you told me in Rome to paint close but look far? I always do that.
Bear's gaze flits expertly across the painting, absorbing 100 details an instant.
Tell you what, Charlie.
I will tell you what. Bear packs his pipe, shaking his head. He looks up.
You did that, son of mine.
Swelling with pride, Pinch nods. With his knuckle, Bear pins down the edge of the curling canvas.
That is one hell of a leg.
Pinch grins.
It's mine, like how you drew your legs when you were in hospital as a kid.
Sure.
Bear continues to scrutinize.
Young artists show me their work all the time. I can tell right away if a guy's got something.
Pinch commands himself to act like a professional. He'd give up his remaining life to hear Dad's admiration for this picture. Pinch blurts, Dad, did you think I could stay here? Here at the house?
You just did, Charlie.
For longer, I mean, to live.
His chest thuds.
If it's okay with everyone.
You serious, Charlie?
His father says. Pinch nods.
Bear pauses. But is that fair to Natty? Doesn't she need you there?
Mum isn't like when you were with us.
Aw, come on, Natty never changes. Sweet girl. And a kid ought to stay with his mother.
He grabbed Pinch's arms.
Son of mine, I ain't the world of you, you know that.
He nods towards his son's paintings.
So I gotta tell you, kiddo, you're not an artist, and you never will be.
Youth. Oil on canvas. 78 by 124 inches. Courtesy of the Bavinsky Estate. Toronto, 1971. 21. He stuffs a bolt of tobacco into his pipe, sucks a matchbook flame to the bowl, and coughs discreetly, browsing the art section of a used bookshop on Bloor, paging through old catalogues, obscure pamphlets, dusty Dadaist treaties that make him sneeze. He crouches to peruse a work on pop art, finding colour plates of works by now celebrated artists, a few of whom he encountered years before at the Petros Gallery with his father. That night, Pinch cooks a lavish dinner for two, having procured the necessary Italian ingredients on College Street. Cans of peeled San Marzano tomatoes, guanciale, black olives, pecorino romano, capers in sea salt. Every ingredient, except someone to eat with. He prefers a test run before inviting a date, just to ensure that everything works, from the saucepans to the conversation. You come from Toronto? He asks the empty chair, reading off a sheet of questions resting beside his plate of steaming rigatoni. He tries again, with different intonation. No, that sounded perverse. Anyway, he'll presumably know where she's from by the time he asks her out. Pinch crosses off that question, and proceeds to the next. Do you like music? Oh, but everyone does. He scribbles this out, printing over it. What type of music? Then, is the record too loud / soft? And, the other day, her name here, I walked past a protest against the Sapina Expressway. What is your position on that? Smirking, he shakes his head. Poor girl. We better hope the food comes out well. Pinch stabs another forkful, raising it to his lips, his mouth watering. There was an interesting question here. He reads down the sheet. I noticed that you... Blob of red sauce. Yourself. He dabs the stain, touches it to his tongue. Too acidic. I noticed that you... Blob of red sauce. Yourself. You what? Yourself? He jumps at the noise of an engine coughing and looks out the window over a tree-lined street of the annex, watching a Volkswagen camper van disgorge record crates and shaggy students. His fellow University of Toronto freshmen are another species to Pinch. They're mere months from high school, one summer since lunch bells and locker smells, testing their new adult privileges, trading rock and roll albums and philosophizing. By contrast, Pinch is a grown man of 21 and presents himself as such. His receding blonde hair, sideswept, a tweed jacket and tie, corduroy bell-bottoms ironed with a sharp crease up the middle. Only his thick sideburns are unkempt, and this is less about fashion than incompetent shaving. He hasn't had a classmate since age 16, when he returned from visiting his father in Larchmont. Upon arriving back in Rome, he told Natalie that he wasn't going to paint anymore, intending to wound her as he had been wounded. Her entreaties only pushed him to burn his best efforts, then his supplies. In the end, everything. What remained was the two of them in a cramped art studio. His aim succeeded. He'd hurt her badly. And she'd stopped trying with him. She decided to move back to London to resume her own art. He could come if he wanted. He didn't, but he had no alternative. So by correspondence from London, he completed his remaining school courses, a minimal burden that left him most of each week free in a dark, cold city. He haunted the museums, watching other visitors, confabulating their lives, wishing for the courage to address someone. At first, Natalie roared through a frenetic period of work, pulling overnighters at a pottery cooperative in North London, talking immodestly about her art, until, with crashing clarity, she saw herself. These pots were desperate, botched. She possessed nothing. Natalie struggled to sleep, grew paranoid, thin, smoking constantly. Once he came home to find her seated in the kitchen, a bread knife resting on her thigh. "Just need to go to bed for 24 hours," she said. "Then I'll get on with things." 2 days later, he watched her being led down a beige hospital hallway. Several spells in psychiatric wards followed. After Pinch received his diploma in the post, he found work as a guard at the National Gallery to bring in a little money, though Bear helped out with fat but irregular checks, and also to escape home, where Pinch found himself insufferable, having assumed the role of nagging parent to his mother. "Open your mouth, so I know you took 'em." Every day at the National Gallery ended with a plunge in spirits as he walked over the Churchill mosaic and out the portico entrance to Trafalgar Square, tensing further as he stepped onto the tube train and rigid by the time it clattered into Belsize Park, their home stop. No matter how fine his day, it was dashed as he walked into their basement flat, hearing her smoker's cough from the kitchen, Natalie barely responding to his greeting, he yearning to tell of a famous museum visitor, say, or a stupid new policy, or the guards from Mauritius who were teaching him Creole. Each night, he cooked their dinner, lest Natalie go without. Left to herself, she consumed only coffee and smokes, a regime that alone could set off another manic-depressive episode. He tried to replicate dishes tasted in Rome, struggling to recall and to find the ingredients, apologizing when his experiments ended in catastrophe. Sometimes Natalie was still loving, and he spurned her then. "I think you hate me," she said. "I don't. Is there anything you like about me?" He changed the subject, never explaining the source of his anger, that she had encouraged him, had adored his painting, had stoked his hopes, telling him, "You are really very good." Yet he wasn't. He couldn't forgive Natalie for that. In secret, he wrote to her estranged mother, asking about Canada. Pinch dreaded telling of his contact with Ruth in Montreal, but Natalie responded unexpectedly, hugging him, holding on tightly, whispering, "So pleased you're doing this," as if she were his mum again. Pinch turned formal, showing her the course catalogue, a map of campus where he'd be living, a collage of information plastered over his guilt. "The funny thing about having a child," Natalie told him, "is that it's really about not having the child. That's what raising one is. Doing everything possible so they're able to leave you. Not that it's a credit to me. You raise yourself, Pinch." "Well, that's not true," he said, hurrying her attention back to his upcoming studies. Now Pinch explores his large new home in Toronto, owned by Ruth, and lent for his time at university. Previously, it was a student flop house. 4 bedrooms bear the scars of former occupants, with psychedelic pen doodles on walls and the stench of wet dog. He ventures into empty rooms, and floorboards creak. In darkness, he stands there, hands on hips. "I must do well here." In class the next morning, he hunches over a small desk, taking copious notes to avoid stray gazes from the surrounding students, all women, which turns out to be the case in most of his art history courses, though nearly all the professors are men. Here, a middle-aged academic in a leather jacket lectures to his pretty favorite, who fiddles with a bouncy pendant. When the prof poses questions, Pinch shoots up his hand, answering in a rush, his throat constricting. "Well," the professor responds, stretching out the pause, "you are correct in point of fact." Pinch didn't think there were points other than fact. Chastened, he resumes his febrile note-taking, throat blotchy. In bed that night, he replays his classroom blunders, burning with self-scorn, tugging at his hair. Barefoot, he opens the refrigerator, plucking pieces of cold rigatoni from a bowl. "Come here often?" he says, smiling at a red sauce spatter on the linoleum. "It was dinner, but is it art?" 22. His emaciated grandmother wears penciled eyebrows that rise in skeptical arcs, her short yellow hairdo pasted down, giving Ruth the impression of a shriveled lemon. On her dining table in Montreal, she places a sweet loaf, candied cherries, and almonds glistening, and she urges Pinch to eat, then to eat more. It's awful. She touches none herself.
I'm on a diet.
Oh, you shouldn't be, Pinch responds, wishing to please the only relative he knows in this country, who's also paying his tuition.
Since 1926.
What is my diet? He laughs. Ruth meant this as wit, yet she appears annoyed at his response. She returns from the kitchen with two china teacups tinkling in saucers, each containing perfectly clear hot water. He sips, unsure if this too is a joke, whether he's allowed to smile. Instead, he thanks her. Much of that afternoon he is expressing gratitude. She wants this, expects this, and repudiates it when offered. Pinch always worried that involving himself with Ruth risked awakening hostilities between her and Natalie. The two women never communicated by phone, only the rarest letters, which Natalie read in fury, one hand clasping the writing paper, the other hand clasping her shirt. Seated across from Ruth, who is supporting him, who is acting far more like family than Natalie has for years, Pinch feels poignant kinship for his absent mother.
What was Natalie like when she was little?
Ruth fails to offer a portrait so much as a case study, telling of crippling anxiety, intense friendships that ended in fiery breakups, a girl who was insufferable in adolescence. Pinch attempts to broaden this account, adding his mother's subsequent accomplishments, how she set herself up overseas, raised him alone in Italy. A framed photo of David sits on the mantel, and he expresses regret that his grandfather died before they could meet.
That's what she told you? Before you were born?
Pinch, distressed to learn of his mother's deception, nevertheless claims that he must have misunderstood. But Ruth pursues the topic, seeking the safety of anger. She speaks as if having wanted to state this for years to correct what her daughter has lyingly fed her Italianized grandson, who wasn't even brought up remotely Jewish, who knows nothing of David, nothing of our past or our lives in Canada.
Did she tell you David put a gun to his head, that he shot himself?
Pinch nods.
Did she tell you that he didn't die? That he didn't do us that favor? Couldn't even get that right? He went on for years, and who had to nurse him?
She jabs her own chest.
Why did he, Ruth?
He was miserable, she says unhelpfully. Kept telling everyone how decrepit he was.
What's funny, she adds with an inauthentic smile, is to shoot himself. You never saw a less violent man. They didn't even let him fight in the war. He was a man who went around on a bicycle, for God's sake. He'd lay upstairs for years, brain half removed. But he was too healthy in body. Wouldn't fade away, not for years. How does a wife say she prefers a sick husband to die? I'll tell you how. It'd be a mercy, meaning a mercy to me.
And to him, Pinch says.
You weren't there. Someone never brought you.
Ruth allows her cigarette to leak a gray curlicue, never inhaling.
Here's the strange part. I was broken up when David did pass away. Why?
She scrutinizes Pinch. He looks to the man's photo. Wiry, bald, stern.
Of everyone, it was your mother who was closest with him. Why else run so far away? Not because she hated me. Well, not only that.
After the subject of David exhausts itself, any other topic seems frivolous. She doesn't dismiss Pinch, though. It's as if she can't face his leaving, so will sit here, saying, "Hmm," to his dull accounts of glasses. Abruptly she stands. He gets to his feet, pledging to return. She tells him to write first. He does so, almost every 2 weeks, asking about her daily life, of which she reveals so little. At first he proposes a return visit, but she never writes back, unless he falls slack in his correspondence, whereupon a two-line letter arrives, containing neither salutation nor her name, just,
"Do you need stamps?"
23. Toronto is swallowed beneath clouds. As the plane shudders, Pinch grabs an armrest, nervously flicking the ashtray, peering in at elbows of cigarettes there. It's summer break, and he is flying back to London. As a freshman, he performed well, but not so superlatively as to gain notice, instead dissolving into the blinking ocean of survey course undergrads. His letters to Natalie described fellow students, told tales of camaraderie, all fabricated. His was a solitary year. He counted down until today. In the rail carriage from Heathrow, he studies English feet, scuffed dress shoes, bandaged pinky toes, the first week of sunshine, sandals still tight. At Belsize Park, he steps into the morning, blinking. Minutes later, he's in her doorway, Natalie before him, only her hair different, shorter now, a black bob haircut with strands of white. He wants to apologize, or thank her, or cover his eyes and think for a minute. She lives in the same garden flat they shared for years, and Natalie herself seems mostly the same, but Pinch finds himself different, realizing only as he steps through the door. She offers a packet of Maltesers. Still your favorite?
I don't often eat sweets in Toronto.
When he unpacked on his first day in Canada, he found packets of Maltesers secreted throughout his luggage.
You must get back into the habit, Pinchy. I bought you lots.
Let me start, then. He opens the packet, tosses a few into his mouth. This place smells exactly like before. She leads him through the kitchen, past her small press cookbooks and jars of carob and sticks of dried rosemary, past her stubby cactus that never takes water and grows measly, defiant spines, out onto the patio. They sit at the bistro table, she shading her brow from the sunlight, steam curling from the cups of mint tea. Natalie has an unreal aspect. She is Pinch's most familiar sight, viewed since before his clocks started. Yet she isn't as he expected, not quite his mother today, but a middle-aged woman.
It's so lovely to have you here, she says.
Natalie speaks of her current pottery, jokes that she works far better without him around. She speaks of colleagues at the craft shop, denouncing them so scathingly that Pinch hears himself defending strangers.
I'm doing better now, she protests. Can't you give me credit for that?
I do. It doesn't sound like it. He mentions Ruth, speaks of her frailty, urging Natalie to travel back to Canada after all these years.
You're taking her side now?
I didn't know there were sides. In less than an hour, they have regressed. While apart, each remembered their fondest version of the other, but the Natalie who wrote him loving letters is absent, replaced by the Natalie of hospital courtyards, hand shivering, struggling to pluck another cigarette from her pack, biting it out with her lips. Pinch tries to force back these recollections, saying, I don't even know what we're talking about. Citing fatigue, he retreats to his old bedroom, drags his suitcase in. He so longed to be here. Now he longs only to hide again under Toronto textbooks. Over the following weeks, Pinch claims a more urgent need to study than exists. He also claims to want long walks on his own, but instead takes the tube to view old master drawings at private galleries. He is obliged to knock on locked doors, his face appraised through the glass, whereupon he is admitted by a fawning clerk, who says with head tilted,
Let me know when I may explain.
Pinch, applying the thickest Canadian accent, responds,
Such neat drawings! Where's the price tags?
After a few minutes of playing the heathen, he poses questions pointed enough to expose the ignorance of the snobbish clerk, whereupon Pinch leaves, flushed with pleasure, stepping into this jostling city, and empty to have nobody to tell this anecdote. What is mischief, if not for retelling? Every minute that summer is tense, he and she stepping around a quarrel that won't explode, but simply exudes.
But what is your life like there? She asks, smoking,
though he's still eating a lamb chop.
You never give me a picture I can see in my head.
You know which classes I take.
Look, we can change your plane ticket if you'd rather fly back sooner.
I never said that. You certainly don't want to be here. Then, 2 days before departure, everything changes. They regress further still, becoming the best friends they were, perhaps are. They sit side by side at the kitchen table, scanning the Guardian for plays, exhibitions, restaurants. Suddenly there's too much to fill the dwindling time. They hasten out for dim sum on Gerrard Street, seated at a vast table by themselves, taking opposite sides of a lazy Susan, each spinning the last dumpling away when the other's chopsticks close in. Shall we get more?
More! More! Tons more!
On his final morning, he is buckling the straps on his suitcase when she appears in the doorway, saying, I hardly slept last night.
Why?
You, she wrinkles her nose. Going. 24. A preposterous young man swans into the lecture hall, ludicrously late for class, and wearing a long Russian coat with ermine collar, froggish eyelids fluttering as he seeks a free seat, only to flop across three in a heap of pastel scarves. Pinch recognizes him as Marsden McClintock, a twit enrolled in two of his sophomore year courses. That is, they have 6 hours in common each week. Failing to acknowledge this fool requires effort, which Pinch is fully prepared to make. But today, Marsden has plonked himself right beside Pinch, reeking of liquor, though it's morning. Pinch leans away, but Marsden's long arm probes ever closer, bearing a note in purple and yellow crayon. "Are you a Bavinsky like he's a Bavinsky?" Beneath is a cloth-bound volume, Modern Art in the Americas, open to a plate of Shoulder 27, 1951. In fine ballpoint, Pinch jots a perfunctory, "Yes, the same," in tiny lower case, as if to make a point about restraint. Inwardly, he is overjoyed that somebody here knows. In their next shared class, Marsden again settles next to Pinch.
"Terrible thing this morning," he whispers as the professor rambles. "I woke up, looked around, and I'm in fucking Queen's Park. I had to run all the way here. Could I still be drunk? Is that possible? By the laws of physics, could I be?"
He drifts to sleep, susurrating throughout the early Renaissance, snorting to wakefulness as everyone else is donning overcoats and mittens. Outside, the tall young man bounds after Pinch.
"Something about Donatello," he guesses by way of recollection. "Then I lost consciousness."
Pinch summarizes the class, leaning into the hard wind, as if impatient for his next engagement, although he has nowhere next but home.
"You know everything," Marsden exclaims.
"I'm just repeating what he told us."
"No, no, you are a genius. How would you feel if I copied?"
"Copied what?"
"Everything for the rest of my entire life."
25. Whenever Pinch trudges up the slushy, slimy steps of the Sydney Smith building, Marsden and his foppish entourage call to their grouchy new acquaintance. As if reluctant, Pinch joins them, frowning, moving from foot to foot in the sub-zero morning. Back when Marsden first buttonholed him, Pinch hastened to his house on Major Street, hung his coat on the rack inside, and ran whooping up to the third floor. Weeks later, Pinch has a distinguished role in Marsden's clique of aesthetes. He is their sourpuss scholar, the future critic of renown. Marsden, who hails from a patrician Ontario clan, his father a leading Conservative member of Parliament, has styled himself a bohemian since age 10 at considerable personal cost. For this, he is resentful of the slovenly interlopers who have tied on bandanas and acoustic guitars in recent years, claiming his countercultural turf. A group of flower children straggle down St. George Street, bandying signs for an anti-war protest while caterwauling Country Joe and the Fish lyrics about the fighting in Vietnam.
"Vietnam?" Marsden heckles them. "Your war zone is the shower."
Back to his friends.
"It's like these people emerge from 3 decades in a yurt. Civilization is not about getting closer to nature. It's about getting as far from nature as possible."
"What's a yurt?"
"I'd tell you, Nigel, but you'd have nightmares."
Marsden looks away, saying, "Now I've lost my train," which makes Pinch see a locomotive rushing past, a heap of pastel scarves piled up in second class. Shortly thereafter, rumour circulates that Marsden has fallen seriously ill, bedridden at his Trinity College dormitory. Pinch buys an orange and sets forth the brave contagion, only to discover that Marsden's infirmity consists of a middling case of the sniffles and a serious case of sloth. He is treating this condition with a combination of gitane and sentimental French records about La Vie de Bohème.
"Why are you in bed? You don't seem ill." "I'm comfortable here, and have yet to hear a persuasive case to leave."
On the wall is a reproduction of Egon Schiele's self-portrait with arm twisted above head. On the floor, a hillock of cigarette butts. Most startling is what scurries beneath his bed, a squirrel that climbed in from the ivy. Marsden claims to have domesticated it, with powerful evidence to the contrary. Starved of admirers, Marsden talks and talks to his surprise guest, catapulting among subjects, lingering on slanders, especially of the bully boys in this residence whose romantic misdeeds he satirizes.
"Sex," Marsden comments, "is proof of the futility of mankind."
"How?"
"Because the sex drive is never quenched. It keeps rising, as it were, and never does one accomplish anything with sex."
"Well, children."
"Not the way I do it,"
Marsden responds, describing himself as a homophile, a term Pinch has never encountered, though he knows enough Latin to understand. It strikes him as sophisticated to take this admission in stride, and he wishes to match it with a revelation of his own. All he can confess of his own sexuality is virginity, which is entirely the wrong direction. So he resorts to ribald anecdotes about his father. Once Bear got his schedule mixed up about when he was supposed to meet his wife, long before my mom, at his studio in Greenwich Village. By mistake, he'd also invited his mistress at that exact same hour. Both women turn up, see each other, and go berserk. It's either she goes or I do. What did he do? Well, he had them wrestle.
What?
Marsden sits up in bed. Yeah, he made them wrestle for his affections.
That's incredible!
Another time, Pinch continues, registering this success, Dad was painting my mother, and he started complaining that her hair was in the way, that he couldn't capture the form of her head. He got a pair of scissors, gave it to her, and said, "Cut it all off, right now."
And she wouldn't, Marsden says, in hope.
Not at first, but he kept on about it. Finally, she couldn't fight anymore, she gave in. And then, as she's raising the scissors, nearly in tears, he snatches them away.
"I only wanted to see if you would," he told her.
"I hope you don't mind me saying this, Charles, but your father is a monster," Marsden says, approvingly. Pinch beams with pleasure. Even if both stories are lies, the wrestling promoter was Picasso, the barber, Giacometti. Encouraged, Pinch drops the names of other art stars whom Bear knows, and he tells of his own visit to New York at age 15, when he attended the opening of the legendary Petros Gallery in Soho, where Dad jokingly introduced him around as an up-and-coming artist.
"You're an artist, Charles?"
"Oh, no, no, I might have wanted to be. I dreamed of it back then, in a stupid, childish way."
"Oh," Marsden responds, pondering the scene. "Isn't that a little cruel, then? Building you up, then packing you off to the provinces?"
"No, you're missing the spirit of it. It was quite a memory he gave me."
"I suppose."
Still in bed, Marsden reaches under the mattress for a bottle of warm Retsina, jams the cork into the liquid with his thumb, splurting a puddle of white wine onto the floor, which encircles the pile of cigarette butts, making a squalid little desert island.
"You're definitely not wicked enough to have been an artist," Marsden comments.
"Aren't I?"
"You suffer the fatal flaw of being quite lovely, Charles, and every great artist has to end up in hell. Then again, imagine how beautifully it'll be decorated."
He passes the bottle.
"What disturbs me is that you aren't more twisted, given your papa. I, by contrast, and never saw a single nude besides statues, yet I end up an inveterate pervert."
"You're hardly a pervert."
"How dare you deprive me of my finest trait? Though, frankly, homosexuality is a simple act of reason. The male body is far more beautiful than the female. That much is indisputable."
"Consider yourself disputed." Pinch takes a glug of wine, a shudder of well-being passing through him. He contemplates the lips of this person. But no, Pinch cannot muster physical attraction, much as he'd like to.
"If men were beautiful, Marsden, why is beauty always portrayed as a woman?"
"Because artists are servants of the rich, and the rich are men. They've always wanted their pin-up girls. Great art is not a matter of sex.
My dear friend, what else would it be?"
As they guzzle the wine, Pinch hears himself admitting to his paltry record in matters romantic. A few flirts as a guard at the National Gallery, a girl or two he fancies in class, each of them cold when he addresses them, as if Pinch might just launch himself on them.
"Well, that's your error, failure to launch."
Pinch speculates that it's his undeniable ugliness, and is slightly hurt when Marsden fails to contradict this. So he shifts to that favoured subject of the lovelorn, personal ambition. His current aspirations took shape while at the National Gallery. Employed to view the crowds, he viewed the walls instead, imagining a Bavinsky there among the Holbeins, Turners, Gainsboroughs. During breaks, Pinch explored the basement reserve, inspecting once-worthy art now relegated to the racks, unfashionable mannerists, devotional works, pictures by dead apprentices of greater dead men. In his ill-fitting guard's jacket and polyester slacks, he visited Svemmer's art bookshop on Charing Cross Road, happening across a biography of Renoir by the artist's son, a volume of aggrandizing rubbish about that mediocrity. Even Renoir could be made important. What if a sublime painter got that treatment? What? Pinch began to think. What if I wrote the biography of Bear Bavinsky? A rush of optimism as he foresaw Dad's approval, not to mention the hours of talk and debate. What if I even become famous for it? He skimmed artist biographies in the bookshop, finding no more sons but plenty of professors. So, that is what he decided to become. The needle reaches the end of a Jacques Brel record. Embarrassing snippets of Pinch's confessed ambitions echo in his ear. He pulls out his pipe, stuffs it with tobacco. That's not for telling anyone, Marsden, just a stupid idea of mine. Don't say that around, if you wouldn't mind.
You brought me an orange, Charles. I consider that an act of heroism, and you spoke in confidence. I hold to privacy as does a cat.
Do cats hold to privacy?
Have you ever heard one talking?
And there's too much talking, Marsden says, in an unfamiliar tone, sincere for the first time in their acquaintance.
You can pull this off, Charles. I'm sure you can.
Absolutely certain, if it's what you want, my friend.
With this, Marsden emerges from bed, shoeless but otherwise fully dressed, in his Russian wool coat over white fencing knickerbockers.
For encouragement, he touches Pinch's forearm, then turns and whistles for his squirrel, Balthazar, to no good effect, before standing at his sash window, gazing into the dark quad.
Never does he refer back to Pinch's needy ambitions, as if words and alcohol should remain suspended in that liquid.
This sensitivity prompts Pinch, weeks later, when the Trinity College residence expels Marsden because of the squirrel, to offer him a room. Fortunately, he leaves Balthazar behind. After 16 months of monastic solitude, Pinch begins to go out by night, walking across the underbelly of Toronto, chaperoned by the protective Marsden, who diverts any bid to lure his earnest scholar into debauch. Pinch even engages in a few trysts with women, whom Marsden introduces. These are affairs with boozy beginnings, sober endings, but they win him confidence. He didn't realize how little he had until it materializes, changing everything from his posture to his voice. Love affairs also reveal a quirk in Pinch's tastes. He is oddly unattracted to any woman he finds beautiful. As for Marsden, his preference runs to rugged older men, typically married, prompting undignified couplings in city parks after nightfall. In contrast to Pinch, he experiences chest-crushing tenderness for beauty, whose sole consummation is physical, brief, incomplete.
26.
Cohabitation, like foreign travel, presents the risk of getting to know one's friends. But sharing a house only brings Pinch and Marsden closer. At times, Pinch finds his shirts ironed or his shoes polished at the bedroom door. When he cannot reach a jar on a high shelf, his lofty housemate retrieves it. If Pinch struggles to open it, Marsden pops the top, neither of them interrupting the conversation.
"You're talking absolute pumpkin," Marsden exclaims. "Artie's too hung up with this right-on politics and dreary conceptualism. My tragedy, dear Charles, is to have been born in this age of brutes."
"I thought you were going to say this age of ugly feet."
"If I had feet like those Philistine hippies, I'd probably like Bad R too, from moral shock alone," Marsden says, ignoring the ringing telephone. "Artists used to strive for beauty. Now they all want to say something. Have you ever heard artists saying things? Bless the little hearts, they're unintelligible."
To punctuate this, he flings the Philosophy of Aesthetics textbook over his shoulder, which is his way of dropping a class. Perceptive, opinionated, highly educated, Marsden suffers from fast-fading passions, result of which are strewn about this house, unread volumes by Sontag, Isherwood, Gide on the staircase, Jan Garbarek albums still in the cellophane, half-finished embroidery on the kitchen table. That which falls behind Marsden ceases to exist, as if it were his duty to start, and others to finish.
"My life is a flurry of inactivity," he once said, and his degree prospects are indeed flurrying into the distant horizon. "What thrills me about pictures is the opposite of saying something."
"What then?"
"Licking a painting," he says, by way of example, "as I so famously did to a rather succulent Philip Guston at the Yannis Gallery in New York, very narrowly avoiding arrest."
"Are you going to get that, Mars?"
Finally, he snatches the phone. "Let me give him a shout."
Marsden covers the receiver, mouthing,
"Your mother."
After Pinch's visit to London last summer, he and Natalie agree to talk regularly. Given the expense of long distance, they limit themselves to 10 minutes per week. When it's her turn to call, the phone rings exactly on time. When it's Pinch's turn, he sometimes fails, humbled by a hangover, or lost in schoolwork or in a swirling conversation with Marsden and cohorts. The following week arrives and Natalie places her call, never approaching Pinch for his oversight. But this is not a day that either of them is expected to call. To his roommate, Pinch shakes his head.
"It seems that he's not around, Mrs. Bavinsky," Marsden reports.
Shunning Natalie only transports Pinch directly to her kitchen. He knows precisely where she's sitting. He waves his arms to stop Marsden from hanging up.
When I say he's not around, Mrs. Babinski, I mean that he is, or has just come around. Not in the sense of unconsciousness, in the sense of... I'll take it upstairs.
Pinch leaps two steps at a time and dives onto his bed, phone receiver flying from its cradle. He catches it.
I can't really hear you, Mum. You need to speak louder.
I'm sorry.
No need to apologize. I just wanted to hear how you are. Been ages.
Not ages, has it? Lately, he dreads these conversations, fearing that oddness creeping back into her voice. Something wrong again, requiring urgent travel there. She's fragile, but so is his current existence. Classes in which he thrives, and a friend. The possibility of returning to what he was before, that pimply boyish self issuing gale-force words when he met someone, it terrifies him. He exerts himself to converse as if Natalie were normal, speaking of his essays and of the snow, but bypassing his social life. To tell of happiness feels disloyal. Both he and she watch the clock, counting down the 10 minutes, each for opposite reasons.
I think of you so often, Pinchy. With such warmth.
He puts down the phone, harrowed, needing to restore himself to this house, this city. Instead, he dials Arizona, where his father lives with his new wife, Charlene, and their toddler, Johnny Boy. Bear is always happy to hear from his Canadian son. Pinch, before speaking with his father, fetches his pipe, sparks it up, grinning at that boisterous, booming voice.
Son of mine, what news from the true north, strong and free?
Versed in art history now, Pinch dares raise topics of his father's expertise, occasionally earning ticks of respect, even stirring Dad's pleasure, which redoubles inside the youth, who presses the receiver hard against his warm ear. Above all, he quizzes Bear on the subject of Bear, his views on life and art, to which Pinch can listen for hours.
Honestly, Charlie, I look at my work sometimes and I think, is that really what I meant?
He says, an echo on the line.
Or is it what I painted because that's the limit of what I can do, and I'm not as good as I need to be?
When Bear is among strangers, he presents himself as one who'll freely tell tales against himself, immune to pomposity, stumbling through the nutty art world. But in private with Pinch, he's far more shrewd. Culture, he explains, is a pyramid. A few on top, many squashed under. You don't say this aloud, he adds, because people want to believe that art is holy, crafted by a clergy of sinners. Pinch smiles, and Bear chuckles.
You like that, kid?
There is an unfunny subtext to this, however, because Bear's work is increasingly overlooked. He is drifting from the history of art and becoming replaced by those who are objectively worse. Yes, objectively. For Pinch deems artistic merit as fact, not opinion. His fury flames that Bear is subject to idiots. The peons who spurn transcendent work, leading the public to mediocrities and condemning a master to darkness. Pinch would hurt someone to correct this. Dad, I know about your new art going only to museums, but maybe you should rethink that. If you let a few go privately again, might that...
The market is a sewer. It needs to be there, but don't make me go look, okay?
No, you're right. Remember that absolute shit we saw at the Petros Gallery? I never witnessed such worthless junk in my life.
Charlie, every piece from that show, every piece, is worth more than anything I ever did.
It won't last.
Says?
Hey, Dad, I've been meaning to tell you something. This idea I've been playing at, pretty much my whole university career, actually.
His hands get clammy, mouth dries out.
Just, obviously, I'm a nobody now, but I had this idea, Dad... How I could become a professor and write books, eventually.
Bear takes a drag on his pipe, which prompts Pinch to relight his own, puffing hard.
Pete's sake, kiddo, finish your story.
So I was planning something. That you concentrate on your painting while I get into academia. Eventually, I end up somewhere influential in a position where I can affect opinions.
Stated aloud, the conspiracy sounds deluded to Pinch. He rushes towards the end to mask his doubt.
If I got your art even a bit of what it deserves, that'd be worth a huge amount. To me. Or, don't you think? I know great art rises in due course, but maybe it can do with a lift sometimes.
Who says great art rises naturally?
That's what I mean.
Gaining momentum, Pinch wonders if this might really be a good idea.
One can't let idiotic criticism take its course, Tad. We've seen its course.
He opens his palm, as if pleading in court, the phone cord wrapped around his forearm, briar pipe gripped in his hand.
Listen, listen, Bear interrupts,
adding nothing, holding the floor, smoke audibly blown from his nostrils. Pinch able to imagine that grey cloud twisting around his beard. Edvard Munch once said, "Paintings are my children. They're all I got." But here's what I say. You, Charlie boy, are a hell of a man. And I think the world of you. You know that? We got work ahead.
I could pull this off, you think?
We're fighting the same war. Comrades at arms. Bear responds. So it's back to work, I say, for the both of us.
After placing down the receiver, Pinch opens the door to the bedroom balcony. He walks out there in his socks, which are instantly soaked and freezing. Breath clouds dissolve as he mutters in the various foreign languages he studies. He shoves a line of snow off the wooden balcony edge, the flakes glimmering as they sink before the streetlight glow. I'm actually doing this. I'm gonna do this.
1975. 27. She pulls the marked Latin exam from his hand and carries it away.
Hey, hang on,
Pinch calls out, hurrying to catch up as she disappears down the stairs.
What are you doing?
Even once they're outside the building, Cilla Barrows, his main rival in the art history master's program, hasn't answered. But she does stop, scanning his answers while lazily chewing the collar of her burgundy roll neck, the fringes of her suede jacket swishing.
Hold it up for me,
she says, when Pinch reaches her.
Hold my own exam for you?
But he does so. She runs her hands through her hair, pulling it tightly back. Looks painful, a deft twist into ponytail elastic, all while surveying his answers. She lights a long, thin white cigarette and holds a loose lock of hair under her nose, smelling it. A recent arrival on campus, Cilla Barrows moves around with more assurance and a better sense of direction than Pinch, even though he completed his entire undergrad here. Since their first master's seminars, she has made herself known, standing over the classroom rubbish bin before class, sharpening pencils and peeling a grapefruit too, devouring it instead of a midday meal while making comments from the doorway, the professor so dumbfounded that he permits it. More than a few teachers have taken to delaying class for her arrival, shuffling papers, glancing down the hallway until, oh, fine, here you are. As for her comments, they're well-reasoned and startling in equal measure, such as when she dismisses the oeuvre of Piero della Francesca.
You're ruining all my favorite artists,
a fellow student whimpered. You'd prefer to live in a dream world, she replied. The student's crumpled expression suggested that, yes, she would. Pinch, still displaying his exam for her, asks, why are you smelling your hair?
Expensive shampoo.
She holds out the strand for him to sniff, but he demurs. The university trustees would be thrilled that your scholarship money is going to cosmetics. I'd be pleased to know that I steal the shampoo from my roommates, she counters. Scholarship money is strictly for cigarettes and whiskey.
You beat me by two, bastard.
93 is still excellent.
Not as.
She lifts the corner of his exam to her mouth, bares her teeth, and bites it, giving a quiver of a smile that holds till she turns, striding away down the frosty pavement. 28. Soon, Marsden has heard too much about Cilla Barrows, so he precipitates a meeting at the small library atop Sydney Smith Hall, where she works part-time, collating pre-war German art journals and alphabeticizing yellowed leaflets on archaeology. Within moments, he makes her laugh and lures her downstairs for a cigarette. It's Marsden who bypasses her icicled first name in favor of Barrows, which pleases her because it evokes her parents, with whom she communicates rarely and opaquely. She is redeemed at the sound of their name, meaning her. From an oil town in northern Alberta, Barrows was blessed in childhood by the proximity of an eccentric librarian who introduced her to the works of Dorothy Parker, Rebecca West, Hannah Arendt. In high school, her education expanded further when several of her father's friends made passes, proving themselves hairier versions of boys in her class, talking just as tediously about hockey and reckoning that any statement from her must be dubious. She toyed with a few grown men, but disliked the results, including a memorable fistfight between two contenders, one's hand slamming into her icy windscreen which didn't shatter. Ingenious engineering, she marveled, seated inside the vehicle, cratered glass inches from her face. She drove around the rutting males and resolved during a gentle black-eye skid that she would live in New York as an adult, never marry, and produce one daughter, her brainy accomplice. After the University of Alberta, Barrows proceeded to grad school in Toronto, where she shares a ramshackle house in the annex with 7 fellow Albertans. Her budding friendship with Marsden,